Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Welcome back. It's 12 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I'm glad you're here. I'm glad Joan Pride is here, too, because she is the best. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and she's bringing along with her what Kiplinger has to say about what's going on in the world these days. Joan, welcome back.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be back.
It's you're all on Twitter, aren't you?
As always, you know me.
Joan, the letter that starts out, you guys got a very good first page here, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
A great idea for a new business. If you've got a good one, you say that now's the time to make your move. Tell us why.
Well, because we've had quite a number of years where venture capital was in the doldrums, but we think the money is flowing again because venture capital funds have been raising a heck of a lot of money and really would like to spend some of it.
They literally sat on billions of dollars for years, didn't they?
Right.
And they kept somehow they kept raising the money. I guess I don't know.
Well, they got pretty badly burned, as you know, in the tech meltdown.
Pretty badly burned. Is that code for financial holocaust?
Right. Yeah. To put a finer point on it, yes.
Yeah, I think the difference between badly burned and what happened to them was like the difference between lightning and lightning bug.
Yeah.
It was rough. It was a pretty bad meltdown there. But you're exactly right. And so they learned a lot about investing, didn't they?
No question about it. But it was a hard lesson. That's the problem.
Right. But what is it that, we actually talked, we had a venture capitalist on the show earlier, or a former venture capitalist on the show earlier this week. And he was talking to us a little bit about what it's like, what it takes to get money from a venture capitalist and that sort of thing. It's not easy to get money, even though I know that there's a lot of money out there, Joan, and they're looking for deals. The average small business owner is really not a prospect to be a venture capital partner.
Well, that's right, because they're the average small business owner probably wants to look for something like an SBA-backed loan or a regular bank loan, or maybe find an angel investor, because venture capital funds tend to invest. They want to have seen a little bit of a track record and a really solid plan for growth. Not that the average small business owner doesn't want to grow, but they're looking for lots and lots of growth because they want to make a lot of money.
That's the reason they're going to put millions, not hundreds of thousands of dollars, but millions of dollars.
Right. And your point is well taken. The average small business owner is probably not looking for millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Don't need that much. Wouldn't know what to do with that much.
Right.
Really?
Right.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
The typical small business. But the other thing is that our goals in life, for most small businesses, our goals in life are really at cross purposes with a venture capitalist's goals in life, and on at least two levels. One is our business is our baby. To them, your business is a means to an end.
Right, because the whole idea, if you go the venture capital route, eventually the venture capitalist will want what you would call an exit strategy, meaning you're either going to end up going public or get into a merger and acquisition or some kind of takeover, so that the idea of the business is your baby wouldn't really wash in that scenario.
That's the second one, and you hit it right on the head. We found companies imagining that we're going to run these companies for the rest of our lives. Okay, we probably wouldn't mind if we got bought out and somebody gave us some shekels and we could ride off into the sunset. I mean, I'm not saying that any of us would mind that. It's
right.
Just that's not the overriding thought on our mind, for a long time. And let me say this. And if it happens, it happens when it needs to happen. We don't force it to happen.
Yeah.
Venture capitalists wake up every morning thinking, exit, exit, exit. How do I get out of here?
Oh, absolutely. And that's been sort of the problem. That's another whole situation that I don't think we go into in detail here, which is that the exit strategies have been sort of non-existent lately.
Yeah. Well, because there haven't been that many IPOs, which exit strategy could include an IPO.
Right.
Because then they can sell their stock. They don't have to be acquired. And I think you may have indicated this a minute ago. And that is one area, one way that an owner, a founder, can accomplish their both goals, what the founder wants to do and what the investors want to do, is which the investors want to get their money out and make a profit. The founder wants to have a growing company he or she can still run, and going public allows them to do that very thing.
Exactly.
So, but there haven't been that many IPOs in the last few years, have there?
Well, that's the problem.
Not that many people. And you know, another reason, Joan, is the Sarbanes-Oxley issue.
Well, that all plays into it together. You know, these later stage companies that should be ready for an IPO are taking another round of private financing. And part of it is the IPO market is still kind of in the doldrums, but the other part is that they wonder whether they really want to go public, knowing all the rules and regulations under Sarbanes-Oxley that they would have to follow.
And it's not just the detailing of it, it's the expense. The expense
can
be prohibitive,
right,
for a young company that's about to go public. I think I've told you that I've interviewed two companies, one bank and one manufacturer,
right,
who in the last 5 years have both gone private again because of Sarbanes-Oxley.
Wow.
The last 3 to 4 years, actually. And I talked to another company that's a $1.3 billion company right now who went public in 96. And the CEO and the founder of that company told me on this show that today, if he were sitting where he was today, where he was 1996, he would not take his company public.
Wow.
That's very interesting. The barrier to entry would have been, now he didn't say that he never would have, but it would have delayed his ability to go public.
Sure.
Maybe 2 or 3 years, if ever.
Yeah, I believe that.
And that's the impact of Sarbanes-Oxley. And Joan, that's got to be impacting the appetite of these venture capitalists.
Well, again, it all sort of ties in together. You know, the venture capitalists, they don't really like to invest in you unless they know that there's an exit strategy at the end of the road there. And that has been one of the things hampering them up till now.
And the Sarbanes-Oxley issue, which, folks, is just, I mean, I know many of you don't live in that world, and I understand, but it is part of the world you live in, whether you realize it or not, and it's one of the issues. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the areas, some of the that venture capitalists are interested in. The other thing that right after these messages is 20 after. Don't cry. She's with the Kipling editors.
And balanced on the precipice, the moment must reveal.
After the hour, I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and my website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. Don't forget to check it out when you get a chance. Use it to your advantage. I think it'll help you. Lots of good stuff there. And don't forget to subscribe to my free newsletter, which comes on Sunday afternoon by email. And don't forget our blog, which is on the homepage or also at jimsblog.biz. And I hope you'll use it to your advantage as well. That everything that we do today is right there on the blog. It brings it right up front, just like your blog does. It's all the stuff that you're working on today, all the stuff you're thinking about today, it's right there on your blog. Well, ours is too. Only ours is multimedia. It includes all four of the, or three, depending on how many I'm doing that day, of the interviews I've done. So, and also an article and some pictures and lots of good stuff. So check that out when you get a chance. Joan Prater is our guest. And Joan, we're talking about some of the things that investors, venture capitalists especially, are interested in. And you guys give us a good report there on this. Talk to us about some of the things. They definitely are still interested in technology, aren't they?
Right, which, and they hadn't been for a while there. Like I said, they had been so badly burned in the tech bust a few years ago. But a lot of it has to do with mobile and wireless devices, which makes sense because that's kind of where the action is right now. And they're looking for new ways of providing consumer applications, you know, getting your stock quotes, your music, your video, and things like that.
Right. Well, and let's differentiate between the technology we have today and the technology, what we call technology in the 90s. What we call tech offerings in the 90s, technology in the 90s, a lot of it was not productized. It was just basically, you know, part of the madness of crowds, you know, the popular delusions and madness of crowds, people trying to create, you know, portals and trying to attract eyeballs, but there really was no critical mass at all. And that's what passed for technology in a lot of ways back then. Today, the technology is real. I mean, it's things that help people. They're products that, that people can buy and use, and it benefits them and makes them more efficient. And so, so I think it does a little bit of a disservice for you and me to compare a lot of the 90s so-called technology with the good stuff that's being produced right now.
Yeah, I mean, boy, when you think about what things were like even back in the 90s compared to now, it's just amazing how fast the innovations are coming.
Way back then, right?
Yeah, way back. I know, way back then.
In the old days, right?
Right.
Healthcare is a magnet for funds, according to Kiplinger. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, and healthcare is sort of was on the wane just a little bit during the tech boom. And when the tech folks went and bust, venture capital firms started looking at healthcare, and by that I mean, they call that life sciences in the tech in the venture capital world, and that can either mean biotech or medical devices.
Right.
So in any case, while tech has been having a tough time, life sciences or healthcare has been really getting the lion's share of attention. And they're looking at illnesses tied to aging, which, of course, is going to be important as the baby boomers retire.
Thank goodness somebody's looking into that for me.
Me too.
Because I hope to be one of the aged one of these days, and I hope that they can do a better job of taking care of me. So good for those guys. All you venture capitalists, invest in all that healthcare stuff.
Right.
I'm gonna be needing that one of these days.
Yep.
Another area that you guys venture capitalists are interested in is a very exciting field, Joan. That's nanotechnology. This stuff is amazing, isn't it?
Well, this stuff kind of blows my mind. I don't completely understand it. It has to do having to do with really, really tiny stuff would be the technical way for me to describe that.
Tiny stuff, almost. And Joan, they've even got some of it at the molecular level.
Yeah, that's the part I don't understand at all.
Well, you know, you've seen the IBM commercial where the guys are lost in the truck and the woman tells them they're lost. They didn't know it. And he said, "How did you know we're lost?" She said, "The boxes told us."
Oh.
So they've got little bits of information, you know, embedded in the boxes that the GPS satellite's picking up, and it told them that they're lost.
Jeez.
And that's nanotechnology in effect.
That's amazing.
A lot of other stuff like that, you know, but what I've had some nanotech experts on the show, and they literally are working on things at the molecular level.
Wow.
Where the dye in your paint on your product, or maybe even the dye, I guess, or something, the way the fiber is made, what's embedded in the fiber of a shirt, for example, can provide information. Nanotechnology is very exciting. Some of the stuff that's going on. Also, Joan, energy, the green part of our world, being more efficient from energy. That's something that the venture capitalists are interested in as well.
Right. And as we say, you know, this is a hot area being propelled by high gas prices. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at financing projects for alternative fuels. And also energy efficient building, which I think is going to become much more important.
You know, Joan, there are so many projects along those lines that nobody wanted to look at until the last year or so. Now people are scurrying around, dusting off those things, trying to get them out there.
Right.
Stand by, quick break. It's 29 after. I'm Jim Blasingame. We'll be right back with Joan Pride. Whatever you do, don't go away.
You're listening to a man whose work is never done.
In a job like yours, even when it's finished, there's always one more thing to do.
And his job is to make your job easier.
It's a very difficult job, and the only way to get through it is we all work together as a team. And that means you do everything I say.
He's Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate.
Welcome back. It's 34 after the hour. Thank you very much for joining me today. If you just tuned in, welcome aboard. We're visiting with Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And Joan, we were wrapping up there on what venture capitalists are interested in. And one of the things we were talking about was the energy issue. I think that was where we left off. And you know, as oil prices continue to rise, as energy prices continue to rise, there's going to be a whole new world of opportunity. It is possible, and I hate to say this, folks, but Joan, it is possible that in 10 years, if gas prices stay high, it's quite possible that we could look back and say, thank God energy prices went up.
Wow. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's possible. It's hard to see that now.
Well, look at the innovation that is being stifled right now. I'm not advocating higher prices.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
I'm not saying that I want this. I'm just saying that you and I both know innovation is being stifled because of the relative costs. And there are a lot of innovations that are maybe not are being developed right now because there's no market for there's no demand for them at the price that it is. And so we may look back in 10 years and realize, I mean, if somebody comes up with a better way to propel our automobiles and that makes the air cleaner and maybe even it's less expensive than $1 a gallon gasoline.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, it is possible that can happen. And so it'll be interesting to see how that works. Joan, let's move over and talk about the economy. I just did a report with an interview with Bill Duckerberg, and he says, Mr. Bernanke says in his report to Congress yesterday that basically the economy is going through some difficult circumstances right now, but it's fundamentally strong.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, it's sort of interesting. Mr. Bernanke was very, I guess, adroit when he addressed Congress yesterday because the markets interpreted his statements as hinting that there could be a pause in the Fed's efforts to raise interest rates. But I think you could look at his remarks either way very easily because he's still very concerned about fighting inflation. And if we keep seeing the CPI going up and oil prices going up, I'm not sure how they have the room to pause.
Well, Bill Duckerberg says he thinks the market was looking for something to get excited about.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. I think they were, and I think they decided to look at the glass as being half full.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, Joan, companies are healthy today. Most big companies have got cash coming out their ears.
Right.
Small companies. And this is all part of the inflation issue, Joan. With the health of these companies means that they've been able to, small and large companies, they've been able to raise their prices, recover some of the increased costs, raise their prices and make a profit, put some cash back and retain some earnings. And you and I talked about this 2 or 3 years ago. When that starts happening, that's an inflationary circumstance, isn't it?
Yes.
And so we're inflation is the product of success, isn't it?
Yeah, no question about it.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah,
but
inflation isn't all bad, as we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. But the main thing is just that Mr. Bernanke wants to do is make sure it doesn't get out of control. And Joan, apparently, according to Bill Duckerberg, the number that he said that he predicted, actually, that the new number on inflation is like 5.4%.
Wow, that sounds pretty high.
That is high. That is very high, no question about it. But business spending, Joan, according to Kiplinger, is going to grow at a rate of 8.5%. That's got to be good news for small businesses who do business with big companies.
Well, we say business spending should be growing faster, so I'm not sure if we are convinced that it will grow that fast. I don't know.
Well, I'm not seeing a slowdown in business spending yet, myself. So it'll be interesting to see how that works. Joe, let's move on down and talk about healthcare. There's a lot of stuff going on right now with the stem cell issue, isn't there?
Oh, and where I am in Washington, there's a whole lot going on with stem cell research.
Bush may veto the stem cell legislation.
Right? Yes, he just vetoed it yesterday.
But yesterday did. Okay, all right. I wasn't sure. I thought he was going to. All right, yeah. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about that, and then we're going to move over and talk a little bit about taxes, an area that Joan Pride knows a lot about. Right after these messages, it's 20 till. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's 17 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, small business advocate. Joan Pride is our guest, and she's with the Kiplinger Editors. And they have an outstanding website, Kiplinger.com is the website. It's one that I encourage you to check out when you get a chance. And Joan, the publications that of course, the one we work off of is the flagship document, the Kiplinger Letter, which has been in publication now since 1923, every week since then. And that's the Kiplinger Letter. And then they have three biweekly letters, the California Letter, the Tax Letter, and the Agriculture Letter, devoted to those great heroes out there, our farmers of America. And then also they got a magazine. Joan, tell us about that magazine. And that's been out since 1949, something like that?
Well, yes, although at that time it was called Changing Times, and then got a revamp maybe, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago.
And all of those things are available from the Kiplinger website, Kiplinger.com. But there's also a phone number, right, Joan?
Oh, yes. Our toll-free number is 800-544-0155.
Check it out, folks. Joan, the president finally did something that he's never done in, what, 6.5 years has it been?
Yes.
No, five and a half years, I guess.
Five
and a half years. He has never vetoed a bill, which is, I think, is preposterous. But
think about it. You know, he does have theoretically, you know, the Congress on his side, theoretically,
right.
Because for most of the time he's had two houses of Congress solidly in the majority Republican.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you would think
true.
He wouldn't need to veto a bill.
It makes more sense, but still, 5.5 years is a long time. But now he has vetoed the stem cell research bill. What's it about?
Well, the legislation would have expanded the ability of researchers, as I understand it, to use frozen embryos to perform stem cell research. And Bush is against that. Bush wants to make sure that those embryos are not used.
Well, and, you know, Joan, this is a really tough issue, isn't it? I mean...
Well, maybe for some people. I don't know.
Well, it is for a lot of people. I mean, I think it's... I have to be honest with you, Joan. I'm not sure where I come down on this one. You know, on the one hand, I know that it's good for us to have the tech, to be able to do the research, and you know, if these things, these embryos can help, that's a good thing. But then, you know, I guess I don't. I really don't know enough about this whole thing, Joan. Because then you see the children that are alive today that because they were allowed to become alive.
Well, I guess
so
my question would be: are we talking about embryos created solely for the purpose of being destroyed, which would be bad? Or are we talking about embryos that have been frozen and are sitting around there and may just sit around for eternity or be otherwise destroyed when they could be put to good use and save lives?
And see, that's where I agree with you. If there are things that we wouldn't have used otherwise and they go to waste, I agree with you. But don't you think that a lot of people who are upset about this, who are with the president on this, are concerned about the slippery slope that we might get into based on the first example you gave? of creating embryos for the purpose of...
Well, I don't see why you couldn't ban that. I mean, you mean the other side of the coin is we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, some people would say.
I hear you.
We're going
but I just
far.
Think a lot of people are concerned about getting us headed down what they consider to be a slippery slope.
And then you have to get into the whole life debate. You know, okay, you're keeping these frozen embryos alive for no purpose while people are dying that could be helped by research.
Mm-hmm. I know.
So it's very complicated.
That's my point, I really can see both sides of the issue, and I have to say, Joan, you know me, I'm usually not slow to take an opinion on anything, but
right.
But I have to say there are some things that I just don't know that much about, and it's hard for me to make a decision on this one, but I don't think you're surprised that he vetoed this bill.
Oh no, not at all.
I mean, this is pretty much, you got to admit that this is not something, you know, whether you agree with him or not, you got to admit that this is something that's part of who he is, the president.
Well, what I find interesting is that the battle lines that are drawn are not strictly along party lines. You've got a lot of crossover on both sides.
Exactly. You know, this issue and immigration are two of those strange bedfellow issues, isn't it?
Oh, no question about it.
Yeah. Joan, let's move over and talk about taxes. This is an area that you're very fluent in. What's the news there with taxes?
Well, the news isn't great. If you are someone who was hoping for permanent estate tax repeal, we're saying that that's not going to happen. And although we see a compromise that would raise the estate tax exemption high enough that most people would benefit from it, we see that compromise probably next year or maybe 2008. I mean, Congress knows it kind of has to do something by 2010 when you have this ridiculous, bizarre law that eliminates the estate tax and brings it back a year later.
It literally goes away.
Don't adjust your dials, folks. That's exactly what I said. I know it sounds
literally
weird.
She's exactly right. It literally goes away. Estate tax goes away in the year 2010. There is no estate tax in 2010, no death tax. But in 2011, Joan, tell us what happens.
Well, in 2010, the larger exclusions that have been getting larger and larger each year expire, and the way I've described it is the estate tax comes roaring back the next year with a very low exemption and a very high rate. I mean, it's going to be kind of a shock to people if Congress doesn't change the law. And you're probably asking, well, why would Congress do this? Well, it's something called the out years and keeping the budget low in the out years.
And it has to do with them having no shame, too, folks. That's another
no
issue
guts.
There.
Right.
Yeah, no guts and no shame. That's exactly right. Where's the leadership? Where's the beef? That's what I'm asking. Tintail, we'll be right back with Joan Pryde. I'm Jim Blassingame. Stay with me.
I feel nice. Sugar and spice. I feel nice.
We're back at 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're having a great visit with our good friend Joan Pryde, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, I understand that the IRS is underwater. Have you heard about
it? Boy, is it ever.
The basement is flooded?
Yeah, I'm sure there's, you know, dancing and singing in the streets. The IRS building is in a disaster.
Bless their little hearts, Joan.
But the bad news is that the IRS is still functioning. I actually talked to one of their employees the other day. I felt very sorry for this gentleman because he normally works in downtown D.C. He's now in an office in suburban Maryland. He said it adds 40 minutes to his commute.
Yeah, and I'm teasing them, folks. We're just having a little fun with them, and they tease
each
other.
Well, and of course, nobody was hurt. Everybody's fine. Yeah. The workers are fine. It's just that who's happy about the, you know, who's unhappy about the IRS building having problems?
There is a certain amount of interest there. I should say. I'll try to be kind, Joan. Let's move on down. Let's move on down. When is Kiplinger going to start doing some stock car race sponsorship, Joan?
Hey, that's a great idea. We'll get into NASCAR.
I think number 49 should have Kiplinger on the side of the car or on the hood or the onboard cam that shows where they're going or where they're coming from should be sponsored by Kiplinger. What do you think?
I think it's a terrific idea.
Yeah. Why would we want to do
a lot of publications that way?
Yeah, So why would I recommend that? You guys got some news about that.
Well, we're saying, you know, the fan base is so huge. You, by marketing to these folks, you can really realize some big profits.
And what they found out is,
and these people are brand loyal.
That's it.
Yeah.
The research shows that these people, they take their stock. And, you know, Joan, there was a time when stock car racing was associated with Southerners and all that sort of thing.
Well, like lower income folks.
Is national. Yeah. And you know what else is, right, what's surprising about stock car fans? More and more of them are women.
Oh, no question about it. Yeah.
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 And these aren't you know, women who work in factories. I mean, some of these women are professionals, you know, and it's stock car racing is, you know, Joan, I have a certain interest in stock car racing, but it's not something that I watch a lot.
Yeah.
I enjoy stock car racing every once in a while. I don't think I watch maybe two or three races all year long.
But what is what is the attraction of watching? My husband does this too. What is the attraction of watching cars drive around a track?
Part of it is the strategy. There's a lot of strategy involved.
Uh-huh.
And of course, for a lot of folks, it's the
there's strategy in paint too, you know,
of a wreck. Or and also, you know, there's all this stuff that the drivers get into with each other. It's interesting. It's like a moving reality show, Joan.
Okay.
So, hey, Joan, let's move down and talk about air travel. Boy, howdy, are prices going up?
Yeah, and I've been reading a lot about this. I mean, we're talking about profits for carriers, and that's because prices are going up. But you know, the planes are fuller, and the experience is rougher, and it's just no fun right now.
There is no glamour. You know, people who know I travel quite a bit on airlines, you know, who don't get to travel much. Oh, that's so exciting. You know, it must be so much fun being able to do this or do that. And I say, you know what? Being there is okay. Getting there, not so much.
Yeah.
It's a mess. And, you just have to get in the right frame of mind. But Joan, it wasn't as bad until the prices started doubling and tripling.
Well, exactly. That's the problem.
Where I used to fly round trip to Tampa or nonstop to Tampa or New York or D.C. for $250-$300, maybe even a little less than that, for a long time, when I thought they should have charged me more because I thought I was surprised at the price. Now it's like $700-$800 or more.
Gee, that's amazing.
That's what shocked people is how much it's changed.
Yeah.
Over the last 6 to 8 months or so is where it's changed quite a bit, Joan. Jonah,
right.
are we gonna get any resolution in the Near East in Palestine? We got a lot of problems over there.
Well, we're saying we're concerned that there isn't an enormous amount that the White House can do to stop the violence. And, you know, I know that the UN and other countries are working for a ceasefire, but we don't see one in the near future here.
Yeah, I don't think the U.S. can do much, and I think we all need to pray for some kind of cooler heads to prevail over there.
Boy, that's,
hey, Joan,
that's right.
Thank you for being here. Good job today, as always.
Thank you, Jim.
See you next time. Joan Pride, ladies and gentlemen, with the Kiplinger Editors. I got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I'm on the road today, but I'll be back in my regular environs tomorrow, and I'll see you then.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.